Now, what I was talking to you about this morning, namely the conception of the universe as a totally harmonious energy system, which may be realized as such at some time or some kind of time, not necessarily future time as we ordinarily understand it. But let's just say there is a point of view from which the whole gamut of being may be considered as completely harmonious. This is called, in the philosophy we're discussing, that is to say, the philosophy of the Avatamsaka, the Dharma Dhatu. Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, Dhatu, D-H-A-T-U. Literally, the realm or domain of the Dharma. The Dharma being this complicated, difficult, indeed impossible Sanskrit word that is usually translated law in English, but which can also mean method, function, rather like our word principle, as in the phrase to get the principle of the thing. It can also have some affinity with our word reason, and it can also have some affinity with our word what is right. So if you've got conduct that is described as dharma or adharma, which is right and wrong, roughly. Dharma Dhatu, therefore, really means the order of the universe, what it is fundamentally. And I was pointing out that fundamentally this order is a harmony. And there is a point of view from which this can be seen. Now, this philosophy of the Avatamsaka Sutra makes a further analysis of the Dharma Dhatu into what are called the four Dharma worlds. And this is one of these mnemonic tricks that Buddhists always use to help you keep things in mind. They group things into four, into five, into six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 12, and so on. They always miss out 11 for some reason. And so that you can memorize it easily. And the four Dharma worlds, or what you might call the four ways of looking at existence, let's call it that, are called in Japanese, I'll use this language because it's easier to remember than Chinese and easier to pronounce. First of all, the world that is called G, J-I. Second, the world that is called Ri, R-I. Third, the one that is called Rijimuge. Ri, G, Mu, M-U, Ge, G-E. And then fourth, the world that is called Jijimuge. Mu. Well, I will go through these things in order. First of all, the way of looking at the world as G. The character G in Chinese has a very complex set of meanings. It can mean ordinarily a thing or an event. It can mean business, that is to say, something that matters, that's important. It can mean a fuss. It can mean affectation. So that a person who might be described as buji in Japanese, no G. Suzuki once wrote me an autograph And he wrote the three characters, Bu Ji Nin, which means a no-fuss man. And Bu Ji Nin is a man of whom the poem says that I quoted to you last week. Entering the forest, he does not disturb a blade of grass. Entering the water, he does not cause a ripple. You know, like those wonderful South Sea Island pearl fishers who can dive, cutting the water like a knife and hardly making any splash at all. This kind of harmonious relationship with circumstances in which one doesn't stand out like a sore thumb, that is Buji, no G. So G, the fundamental meaning, is whatever it is that stands out. That is to say, the distinct, the particular, the individual, the sharp. So in contrast with G, which is one point of view toward the world, is Ri. Ri is a Chinese character, pronounced by the Chinese Li, which almost all of you will by now be familiar with, because I have explained in previous seminars that this character means, fundamentally, the markings in jade, or the grain in wood, or the fiber in muscle. Now, at the stage of Chinese history that we're talking about, which is 712 AD, when this particular philosophy was really matured by Fatsang, the word Ri or Li meant what I've been referring to all along as the undefinable substratum of things, like the mirror underneath all the various reflections in the mirror, or the diaphragm of the radio underlying all the sounds which the loudspeaker produces, or the eye as fundamental to sight, the ear as fundamental to sound. So you could put it this way then, that what G stands for is the individual reflections in the mirror, and what Ri stands for is the mirror. Fatsang himself explained it to one of the Chinese emperors by the image of a golden lion, and he wrote a long treatise on the golden lion, which if you want the whole thing and want to study it carefully, you will find in volume 2 of Feng Yulan's History of Chinese Philosophy. This is incidentally, anyone seriously interested in these things should possess these two volumes published by Princeton. And in the second volume, he has a long, long exposition of Fatsang. And the nice thing about Feng Yulan is he's a very conscientious historian, because most of his book is quotations. He simply weaves in the original sources with explanatory help-outs and just lets you have it. And I think he's extraordinarily good. But he does, he's not easy reading. But he has the whole of the Golden Lion exposition here, which Fatsang used to make the Huayan or the Garland doctrine comprehensible to a slightly stupid emperor. I say slightly. So he used the idea of the golden lion because he used the form of the lion to represent G, that is the individualizing principle, and the gold to represent Ri, which is the underlying. And you remember we discussed this last week because in another way and from another point of view, we were talking about the Western distinction between form and substance and how we have grown up with our common sense geared to the idea that every shape is a shape of some stuff. But we consider the shape principle, the form principle, to be spiritual, and the stuff principle to be material. In other words, form is a higher order of being than matter. because we think of matter as stuff, the form of the pot is a higher principle than the clay out of which it is made. That's the way we think. But in this Buddhistic and Hindu way of thinking, it's exactly the other way around. The gold is used to represent the higher principle, and the form of the lion is used to represent the material. Because, you see, there isn't a word in Sanskrit that corresponds to our word material. They use rupa, and rupa means form. When, in other words, a Sanskrit thinking person wants to indicate what we call the material world, he doesn't really say material, he says formal. The world of form. Then when he wants to indicate higher worlds that are spiritual, he calls them arupa, which are formless. So in his way of thinking, the gold underlying the form of the lion represents a deeper, more basic order of reality than the form of the lion. You have to get used, you see, to these funny flips in metaphor as used between Chinese-speaking peoples or Sanskrit-speaking peoples and English or German-speaking or Greek-speaking peoples. So the point now that he's established these two ways of looking at the world. You can look at it from the point of view of all the jazz that everything is doing. You see? All the forms, all the dances, all the patterns. And those are G. Then you can look at it from the point of view of what is it doing it all, or what is it all happening in? What is, in other words, the medium or the basis which is all this universe? And that is called Re. Although by a funny flip, at a time later than Fa Zhang's, that is to say, we'll have to go on in Chinese history to the Neo-Confucian philosophy, which will take us to the 14th century, where the word Re comes to have the meaning of the organic pattern of the world. Where the full meaning of the idea of markings in jade, which it originally had, is brought out again. For a period here, under the auspices of Buddhism, Re roughly corresponds to what we mean in Western philosophy by the word noumenon, as distinct from phenomenon. Roughly. You see, noumenon is based on nous, which is mind. Phenomenon is based on phaino, which means to show, to manifest. Manifestation of mind, or in information of the formless. Because, you see, fundamental to the whole Hindu-Buddhist complex is the notion of the world as being something like what happens when you develop a photographic film. You look at the film, and first of all, in the solution, it is formless. There's nothing on it. And then suddenly, all over the area that you're watching, a picture develops. It doesn't develop across in that order, or down in that order, but all over at once it comes out. And they feel that nature works in rather the same way. There is the whatever it is, you see, the vast, unnameable continuum, and this manifests itself like the film developing. So every G is a thing or event. Re is the continuum in which things and events occur. But as a matter of fact, the two are not really different from each other. Now this gets us to the next principle and the next step. The third so-called Dharma Tattu or Dharma world is called Riji Muge. And that means that between Ri and Ji, there is no inconsistency. The word Ge literally means a blockage, but probably inconsistency or separation. You could use that. No separation. Riji Muge. No separation between Ri and Ji. Now he goes with the idea of the gold lion, he puts it this way. You can't ever find gold that is not in some form. If it's not in the form of a lion, it'll be in some form. But you can't find a lion without the gold. In other words, the lion, even if it's a living lion, has to have some Ri underneath it, as it were. This is the Oriental meaning of the word substance, as distinct from our meaning, which is stuff. So the gold and the lion are in a way inseparable. You can think of them separate. You can form the abstractions of gold on the one hand and lion on the other. But actually, the form, the G and the Re, will always go together. So then, Ri, Ji, Mu, Ge, no separation of the Rupa world, that is the world of form, and the formless world, is when you see there is no incompatibility between what we could call the spiritual and the material. Now this is an idea very, very simpatico to the Chinese. It hasn't been a very popular idea in India. It did originate in India. But the Indian mind is to a large extent, in popular sense, very, very disillusioned with the formal world, which is always falling apart and which is painful and which is a struggle and a mess and everything like that. And they long for the formless world. And so when you listen to most Hindu teachers, they will encourage you to become as spiritual as possible and to renounce the material life of family, delight in the senses, sex, all that sort of thing is kind of out. But the Chinese never could see that that was a sensible point of view. The Chinese social order is essentially family-oriented, and their celibacy makes no sense to them at all. So although there have been Chinese ascetics, by and large, they don't dig that. So it appealed to them very much that there could be this philosophy of a view of the world in which Ri and Ji were perfectly compatible. So then, what is being said here is that, to go back to my image, the mirror and the images in the mirror. You will never see the mirror unless it's reflecting something. There is no way of there being a mirror which is not reflecting. So, in other words, don't look for the principle called Re as something different from the G. In other words, when you wake up and understand that there is something behind existence, you are not to expect to find a big, vast blank. A lot of people think that when they attain nirvana, all individual forms which they see before their eyes will slowly melt and become gooey, like the dissolution of the negative, the forms in the negative, back into the formlessness behind, as if that would happen. See? So it's not going to be that way. What you're going to find out is this, that all things as you see them, being quite distinct from each other, and all the shapes and the differences of people and everything here, that those which differences, you see, which you are noticing in the world, those things, those events, are not really separate from each other at all. They are the same thing as the G, I mean the Re underlying it. It's important then to see that in nature, in the real physical world, there aren't any separate things. The idea of separate things is no more than an idea. It is a way of talking about life. To get to this, we have to go, of course, to the fourth step in the series, what's called Jiji Muge. And this is the image of the net of jewels. And this is the central image of the whole Avatamsaka philosophy. There is a net, like a spider's web, covered with dewdrops in the dawn. Only this web is multidimensional. In other words, it's not even a three-dimensional web. It's more and more and more, as many dimensions as you could possibly ever imagine. And on this web, every dewdrop contains the reflection of all the other dewdrops. This is a way, an image of saying that everything implies everything else. That take any detail, any possible feature of the universe which you can in any way identify as a thing, and if you really go into it, you will have to see it as capable of existing only in the context of everything else. So, each thing implies everything, because it could not possibly have... Let's just take it this way. Where is anything? You can only define a where of one thing in relation to the where of all the others. You can only define the size of a thing in relation to other sizes. You can only define the length in time of a thing in relation to other lengths of time. You see? So that there is, for example, a point of view from which a very small thing like this little clamshell here could seem to be enormous. And you can very easily get this point of view. All you have to do is to hold this in your hand and transfer your consciousness into a tiny creature wandering around inside this huge shell. Why, it's colossal. Or else you can go the other way and you can think of all the galaxies as molecules in somebody's hair in another world. See? Well, it's really very little. It all depends on your scale. But the point is this, that every insofar as anything that you can possibly identify as a thing or as an event goes with, let's coin this word, the word goes with all other things whatsoever. And I think in the seminar we mentioned this technique of making holograms, whereby with laser beams you can take any photographic negative and from any part of the negative reconstruct the whole. Well, it works the same way, that any G is what it is only in relationship to, in context with, all other G whatsoever. And this is often also called the doctrine of mutual interpenetration. And this is the key to understanding what I was trying to describe this morning as the experience of the universal harmony. I remember once a woman I met had an accident, and she was trapped in an elevator, but it caught her leg, and her leg was broken, and she was trapped there for half an hour before anybody could rescue her. But she said, I came in that time to realize that in all this universe there was not one single speck of dust that was out of place. Because this again was somebody accepting a situation about which nothing could be done. And that would, of course, include accepting the fact that you can't accept it. That there it is. And then suddenly this extraordinary way of feeling comes to you, that everything goes with everything else. It isn't, it's curiously different from what we would call the fatalistic sense. The fatalistic sense means I submit to a higher power. Something arranges everything and I don't have anything to do with it. I have no responsibility and I just go because I'm an automaton, you see. That is a rather different attitude than what I'm trying to describe. It's rather passive. This one is like this. My talking to you now is inseparable from the gulls flying out there. Now you may say that's rather a far shot to call, you see? But as a matter of fact, let's start putting it all together. We're living in a nice little town here by the water, and by a combination of events, I make this place attractive, so you come. And that, if there weren't gulls around here, it wouldn't be the ocean, you know. Gulls and ocean go together. And so this whole complex of things, it isn't just that I'm in a vacuum, you see. But it all goes together, and it all goes with every single one of these houseboats, and it goes with every kind of cruddy piece of falling off paint, on rotting wood, and the whole bit all interdepends. And if you get to see this one day and you realize, you know, you felt terrible because you did this, that and the other which you shouldn't have done, and suddenly you realize, go back over your own life. Supposing your friends, parents and relations had never done anything wrong, or what they thought was wrong. Think of the opportunities you would have missed. It fits. And there is this sense, then, that you get that the whole pattern that you can feel out of your existence and one thing with another is completely logical. All goes together. Now, you see what this is a kind of fulfillment of what all scientists are trying to do. When we say, when we ask of any behavior whatsoever in the world, can we explain it? We are asking, is there a reason for it? And what we are looking for is to be able to fit it into a consistent pattern. Now let's suppose, for example, that we say somebody has done something quite unreasonable. Well, then some psychologist comes along and says,
yes, I agree from a certain point of view what he did was unreasonable, but you haven't looked fully into this thing. You don't realize all the complex of causes that were operating in this situation. And if you did understand that, you would see and understand exactly why the person behaved in this unreasonable way. The whole faith of science is that the universe is explainable this way. That we can, in other words, make out a super pattern in terms of which all sub-patterns make sense. If we are going to say there are some things that will never make sense, there are some things which simply have no explanation whatsoever, this is also a way of saying, or it is amounts to saying, that they don't exist because they are not connected. There is no rational explanation of their being there at all, and so such things must be flukes. Not only flukes, but complete cosmic madnesses. Now, when you call something a cosmic madness, something that is a total fluke for which you haven't got any explanation, all you're saying is, my mind isn't big enough to get the point. And we have to admit there are many things going on which puzzle us profoundly, and our minds have not yet acquired a way of explaining them. There are reasons for this. There are reasons that the patterns in terms of which we explain things, let's take for example the pattern of causality, mechanical, Newtonian causality, is a rather limited pattern, and not everything will fit it. But as we think more and delve deeper, we get concepts which are more generous, concepts which accommodate the behavior of the world more subtly. The patterns we are using are more ingenious. Now, there comes a point, of course, at which I see it all fits together. But I can't tell you quite why. Because the pattern in terms of which it all fits together is simultaneously too complex and too simple to talk about. Because you see, we're getting back to this thing which is the medium in which it all happens and which can't be defined. I glimpse that, you see, and get that feeling. Oh, yes, of course. It really does all go together. But at that moment, the philosopher will challenge me. He says, yes, look here, we thought out things in terms of science. We've thought out orders. We've thought out equations. We've thought out patterns in terms of which events are predictable. And therefore, we know they're fairly sure. But you are telling us something which doesn't help us to predict anything. Because you're saying that even the unpredictable is included in this. And so you are not telling us anything at all. And that is quite true. But the most important of all things to tell is the nothing. Because that's the basis. That's why you don't pronounce the name of God. Why it's unspeakable. So, there was a Zen monk who said, I had the most marvelous teacher. I was very lucky. Because he never taught me anything. In other words, he never told me a word. All he did was sit around in a gruff kind of silence while this poor student knocked himself out against him. And you got the point. See, this is the problem, that if there were a point you could get, you see, and say, now I have really got this. I understand what universe is, what life is all about, and now I know, you see, it's like that. Well, you would have only got part of it. You would say, well, now, wait a minute. What's outside of this? See? You'll be looking around the corners. Oh, wait a minute. Well, where does this fit in? See, this thing I've got. Now, for the sake of the tape recorder, I have to say that I'm, as it were, holding a ball in my hands. And I've got it, see, but there's something outside the ball. The really important thing that you need to get is what would never possibly be grasped. That is to say, the situation you're in, that is you. No way of getting that as an object, focusing on it, defining it, pinning it down, none whatever. And in that sense, the whole situation is no thing, nothing. You can't particularize it. So much for that. But actually, this thing that we call, I don't want you, you see, to think of the no thing as something like homogenized jello. You see, that's not the point. It isn't like that. It's like everything, with all the details. And with all, you see, this is why, I must say, in a matter of art, people who try to communicate mystical visions, there are two schools of artists who communicate mystical visions, the precise school and the vague school. And the vague school, which I don't really go for, I saw my son-in-law brought me over the other day a book of pictures of angels. But the trouble with them was they all looked wispy. They were all cloudish forms, vague reflections in water, whooshy things. Now, when I think of an angel, I don't think of anything whooshy. I think of something in which the detail is so vivid that you say, ooh, look at that. In the same way as when you look at some marvelous flower or peacock feather, for example. Look at a peacock feather and every kind of tiny little unit in it is all there. See? Now, this is the point. That this world, to be seen in its unity, must at the same time be seen in maximum detail. It isn't a question of fuzzing the details. This is what meant by Gigi Muge. Between thing and thing, event and event, any detail, any line you can draw, there is no separation. Because you see, what we call lines, and draw them as clear and clean as you will, they join, every line joins its two sides together. It is a boundary in common between two areas. See? Look, the black yang, I mean, the white yang and the black yin are as different as can be, but they go together. And the boundary line, the S-curve between them in the thing, joins them. So this is why a great deal of high visionary art, which attempts to express deep mystical insight, is fantastically detailed and has tremendous precision in it and is not wishy-washy stuff at all. And so this will explain why I will show you some examples today or tomorrow of the type of Buddhist painting that comes out of this school of thought, and you will see what a miraculous world of wonder is in it, of extraordinary detail. Because this is the vision that you get when you start exploring. You take a flower, and you take a big magnifying glass, you go down into that flower, and you find out that the petals are composed of veins. And out of the veins come funny capillaries, and suspended between the capillaries are these filaminesses of petal. And this filaminesses of petal are made of tiny little dots, that little ripple, you see? Everything like that, you see? Then you're looking into the lotus image. So you're seeing the detail. But the point that you have to get is that these details are not separate details. They all go together. So that every wiggle in the vein of the petal is part of the same thing that you are being there looking at it. Just in other words, as the flower may be considered as a unity, with all those veins and things moving out from the center, so in exactly the same way, we sitting here are doing something just like that. Only we are doing it with such a tremendous free-floating jazz to it. You see, we come from all over the place. We are like this, but just because we do it with that immense amount of free-floating jazz, we make the most extraordinary unity when we sit around and talk, or whatever you do. Well, let's have an intermission.